get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know. Like, you know I'm the man, don't you? Can I count it off? 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a Christian worldview. Transcend partisanship and political ideology with us as we seek true discipleship in the public square.
This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, brought to you by the AND Campaign. Justin, it's always good to be with you and glad to be with you this week. How are you?
Always a pleasure, brother. I couldn't think of anybody I would rather talk politics with, man. So I'm glad to be here as usual. It's been a long morning already, though. As I'm sure people will heard by the time this comes out, there's a lot going on in Chicago. Just a clash and a downtown really taking a beating. I don't have a lot of the details, so I'm not going to get into details and say what happened or what didn't happen. But I will send prayers to the leadership and the people in Chicago. There is a lot going on. I hope that they get to the bottom of it and find a way to just serve the people. But it's tough down there. And I would ask that everybody kind of extend prayers for that area and what's going on in Portland and other places. And that's not to compare the two, but just to say that, we need a better way forward. And so just stay in prayer for brother.
Yeah. And, AND Campaign has so many pastors, and we have our chapter in Chicago. And so, thinking especially of our close friend, Chris Butler, but also Pastor Dates, Daniel Hill, Brian Dye, just folks that, are often called on in moments like this. And so praying for their leadership and stewardship of their congregations and people. But yeah, we'll stay tuned on this. And if it's appropriate to talk about it next week, we'll do that. But Justin, we do have quite a bit to talk about already this week. Let's start with the first topic. And I'll be honest, I think we could spend multiple episodes just on this because there's so many different threads, so many different sort of angles to discuss. Here are the basics. We know that Congress has been heading towards a fourth coronavirus relief package. Senator McConnell said it months ago. Democrats have wanted a fourth package. Negotiations appeared to be stalling out last week. Republicans were advancing a $1 trillion bill. Democrats advancing a $3 trillion bill. That's a pretty big gap. Late last week, President Trump stepped into this gap with four executive orders. And I'm just quickly, here's what they address. And then there are comments to be made on each of these, but I'll just lay out the issues he addresses, and then I'll turn it over to you, and we could have a discussion. But the executive orders address unemployment aid, and Trump's executive action calls for a $400 per week in unemployment aid. That is a drop from the $600 that was approved by Congress in the last bill. So it addresses that. Assistance to renters and homeowners by encouraging federal efforts to help renters and homeowners avoid eviction or foreclosure for failing to make their monthly payments. The order directs his administration to identify funds to provide temporary financial assistance to renters and homeowners. It addresses a payroll tax holiday. This has been a controversial position. The Trump campaign is kind of selling it as a tax break. Democrats are saying that it'll pop right back, that it's a tax delay, but folks are, as of now, still going to owe these taxes. So they're saying the executive action here doesn't hold up. And then it addresses student loan relief through extending the interest rate and suspending federal student loan payments. I have so many different sort of things to say, but that sort of as you look at the actions Trump took, obviously there's been a conversation about whether they accomplish what he says they will accomplish, whether they're legal at all, although it was interesting Chuck Schumer had the opportunity on the Sunday morning shows yesterday to say they were illegal, and he and Speaker Pelosi haven't sort of made that accusation. What do you think about Congress's inability to act or unwillingness to act, and President Trump sort of stepping into the void here with these executive actions?
Yeah, I think, you know, we always have to frame this conversation. And the way I want to frame it is by saying this, and this is why it's so important. 5.4 million unemployed Americans won't be able to cover their living expenses without an extension of unemployment benefits. So I think that's a good way to start the conversation, because it frames it and it puts skin on whatever policy or bill that you get through. And that's what I think. Yeah. I hope the Senate and the House keep in mind. I mean, that's a big deal. Now, as you mentioned, there's a $2 billion gap between what both sides want to do. One of the other interesting things about this is some Republicans in the Senate have already said, I'm just not voting for another relief bill, which means that right. It gives the Democrats a little bit of leverage, but apparently not as much leverage as Republicans Republicans don't think it gives them as much leverage as the Democrats would like to think, because they're still very much playing hardball, even though they're going to need those Democratic votes to get something significant through the Senate. So that's kind of the background of what's going on. Michael, I think you covered the $400 a week versus the $600 a week very well. And I want to talk a little bit about executive orders, because so much of this, you know, kind of surrounds.
Please do. What's going Please on with do. This
executive order. Yeah. executive orders, just so you know, and you guys know that the AND campaign is about raising civic literacy. So we're not just here to give you commentary. We want to make sure you understand what's going on. Executive orders are basically directives from the president to administrative agencies, or, you know, usually government officials. The source, now, anything that the president does, right? So this is a directive, and we understand that anything he does has to have authority, right? He has to have the constitutional authority to do something like that. And the source of the authority for executive orders is Article 2, Section 1 of the United States Constitution, which references executive orders giving the president the power to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. To take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Now, as an attorney, that gives a lot of room for interpretation. Right? But I think this is about making sure that the laws are faithfully executed, not to make what would amount to a new law. Okay, and that's really where the dispute about executive orders lies. Executive orders are not meant to be an alternative to legislation. Congress has the authority to make legislation. The president does not have the authority to create or pass legislation, right? And so an executive order is not meant to usurp Congress's power, the legislative branch's power, meaning that a president should not be able to resort to an executive order because he can't get Congress to move legislation. This is the problem that a lot of conservatives and some constitutional scholars had with Obama's DACA executive order. They'd say that it went too far and was the equivalent of legislating from the executive branch, because since, you know, we couldn't get comprehensive immigration reform done, Obama went to the DACA executive order. And I think anyone, you know, whether you agreed with it or not, we've talked about DACA. We think DACA as something that helped immigrants was a good thing. You still have to admit that there's an argument that it was an overreach. Now, whether you think that overreach was necessary or not, you got to admit that there's an argument there. I don't think it's something that you should just dismiss. Now, Congress and the courts do have the ability to overturn an executive order if it's outside the scope of the president's power. And we've seen that done before. I think it happened to a couple different presidents and President Truman. That's who it is I was looking for. I think President Truman tried to use the steel industry and kind of make it part of the federal government, kind of took control of it, and the courts pushed back on that. OK, so that does happen. And so if you just to take a historical look at what's going on, no president used more executive orders than Franklin D. Roosevelt, who we know was serving during the Great Depression. Roosevelt issued over 3,000 executive orders. In comparison, just some more recent folks, George W. Bush issued 291 executive orders. Obama issued 276. And Trump, at this point, has issued under 200 in his first term. We've heard, you know, there's some executive orders that we're all, I would hope, familiar with. We know the Emancipation Proclamation from President Lincoln that freed 3 million enslaved African Americans was an executive order. FDR, again, used an executive order to create the Works Progress Administration, which was meant to create jobs for the American people, again, during the Depression. But he also used it to place Japanese Americans in concentration camps during World War II, right? So they've been used in good ways and bad ways. There's some disagreement on it. Generally, it's one of those things that people complain about when the other party does it, but don't condone and defend when their party does it. Thankfully, Ben Sasse, Senator Ben Sasse, who's been very quiet lately, it's been kind of weird. But he did speak out against Trump's executive order. He basically said, look, it was wrong when Obama did it, and it's wrong now, and that Republicans would be wrong to stand by it when it, you know, when it's something that shouldn't have been done. To your point, though, it's interesting that Schumer and Pelosi have not said that it's illegal. Right. And maybe it's the precedent that was set by Obama, or maybe it's that they figure if Democrats win the White House, they may be using quite a few executive orders themselves. But I think one of the things that I'm trying to get through to people is it's nothing to play with. I mean, you should be wary, whether it's your party or another party, of how the president uses executive orders. Because, yes, we vote in the president, but we also vote in the Congress, and they have a job to do, even though they don't always do it. And he, you know, you don't want to put it in a position where the executive is taking powers that the executive does not have. So something to keep an eye on, and something, again, that may play a role in the next administration. But even for this administration, it's become a pretty big issue.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to pick up on that a bit. You're exactly right. There are a number of reasons to be wary of executive orders and actions like this. One of which you alluded to, is that it lets Congress off the hook. You know, one of the reasons, you know, Congress didn't act on comprehensive immigration reform, one of the reasons why Congress doesn't act on a whole lot, is because they now feel like they can get away with not having to make tough decisions, and that if something really needs to get done, the executive branch will just take care of it because the buck stops at the Oval. And so that's a situation you don't want. The second thing I'd raise with executive actions, and especially executive orders, is that it's hard to hold a president accountable for them. And it's hard to say, when the American people vote for a president, that they are considering in their vote these sort of actions. And so in my view, it weakens democratic accountability. It weakens trust in the civic process. I mean, I think just the average person with any level of understanding of civics has a baseline assumption that, you know, that it's the House that controls the purse, that it's Congress that approves funds. But then they read in the newspaper that Trump is unilaterally extending benefits and unilaterally sort of changing the benefits that Congress voted on and approved. And I think reasonable people are saying, well, what's the point of Congress passing legislation? What's the point of voting for members if they're going to sit on the sidelines? Well, while presidents, again, of both parties, and this is really important. Justin's absolutely right. This is a problem with the way our government is functioning in the modern era, which is congressional impotence and a strengthened executive. So, I think those pieces are important. We probably don't have time today to walk through some of the various pieces. I've said previously on the show, the unemployment benefit piece, that after reflection, and frankly, after working through some reflex reactions to unemployment benefit debate. You know, I do think there's a debate to be had about whether $600 of unemployment benefits per week is too much. Not because I think folks who aren't working don't want to work or are lazy, but because I think folks who are collecting $600 a week for not work when their jobs are paying them less are just not dumb. They're not going to go back, give up those benefits to go back to work. Now, one way of addressing that is making sure people are getting paid more for their jobs. But I did just want to revisit that issue I think Republicans have a point that Democrats haven't answered in good faith here, that we've seen restaurant owners and small business owners raise. Was there anything else in the executive order package or the package of executive orders that stuck out to you, whether it was student loans or I know we're going to be talking about rent and evictions later on, but anything else from the executive orders that you wanted to pull out?
I'm glad you hit on what you did. I think we can too easily see the tweet that, you know, Republicans want 400 and Democrats want 600. And if you're Democrat, you say, wow, aren't those Republicans just really mean? If you're a Republican, you say, man, those Democrats are, you know, too lax on that. They're not paying attention. And so I'm glad you brought that up to say, no, it is a conversation we need to have, right? It's not necessarily just something that people said, I don't want you to have money, I want you to starve. We realize that it creates certain incentives. And it is smart of a person, right? If you're already in a position where you're struggling, you're going to go to the place where you get the most money, right? That's just a logical decision. So I don't think, you know, no way's being condemned for that, but it's something as when you're making policy, it's something that you have to consider. I think a lot of people are interested in what's going on with the student loans, whether it's deferments or whatever. That's very important at a time when people are just struggling to get through and people are really questioning the way that, you know, our student finance system is set up. And so those are things to keep their eye on. I just wanted people to really understand the process and why there's this big back and forth. Hopefully Congress gets it together and gets something done ASAP. I would even like to see a moratorium on all this commentary. I think our folks in Congress are great commentators on Twitter and everywhere else, but that's not why we put you in office. We have people that commentate. We want you to do your job. So let's put a moratorium on that until you guys get something done.
That's good. Yeah. So both McConnell, the administration, and Democrats have expressed that they're not foreclosing negotiating a deal that would override these executive orders. So we'll keep our eye out for that. It may work out that these executive orders, just because of the uncertainty they promote, and that would be my other criticism of executive action, because the constitutionality or the legality of them is so often up for question. When you're dealing with something like unemployment benefits or what tax cuts people will have and what they have to pay back, you want certainty, not the threat or the shadow that these things might not hold up. That was the same problem with DACA. You know, it was a very sensitive issue, and yet you had, you know, thousands and thousands of people who, you know, because of the executive order had protection, but that executive order was fragile, as we saw it get challenged in the Supreme Court. Really enjoyed that conversation, Justin. We're going to take a break. When we get back, we're going to talk about an article that was published yesterday on the cover of the Times that got a lot of attention from Elizabeth Diaz. The title of that article was "Christians Will Have Power. Christianity Will Have Power." We'll talk about that after the break. This is the Church Politics Podcast.
This episode is brought to you in part by Matthew 5:9 Fellowship, who supports evangelical pastors and leaders in shepherding their communities to live the gospel and place their identity in Jesus Christ above partisanship and societal divisions. Jesus has called his disciples to be peacemakers, and that call is particularly needed in our often toxically polarized society. The Matthew 5:9 Fellowship provides resources to help pastors, leaders, and their communities faithfully navigate difficult issues without dividing over them. It fosters relationship by connecting like-minded evangelical leaders across the country. Also, they care about the personal well-being of pastors and leaders, so they provide space and opportunities to experience spiritual renewal to ensure leaders flourish both privately and publicly. A polarized country needs a peacemaking church. Check us out at Matthew59.org, sign up for our monthly newsletter, and download free resources such as our Transcending Toxic Polarization booklet using the code Matthew59.
We're back. This is the Church Politics Podcast. Elizabeth Diaz, who's a religion reporter for the New York Times, has been working on a story for months where she sort of went back and revisited what she views as a pivotal speech from Donald Trump. And I happen to believe this speech was a really critical one, too. In January of 2016, Donald Trump went to Sioux Center, Iowa, and spoke at Dort College. And I have a bit of context here. I spoke at Dort maybe a year ago. It's a heavily reformed community. A lot of various denominations of reformed Christians in Iowa, heavily white, I think 97% white. And Donald Trump went to Dort at a time when his campaign was still, fragile in the Republican primary, and sort of made up to that point one of his most direct appeals to Christian voters. Diaz profiles some of these Trump supporters, sees whether they're going to support him in 2020, I think for folks who read this stuff often, much of the story will ring sort of familiar in sort of media commentary journalism about evangelicals. There were some interesting pieces. I'll just pick out. I was happy that Diaz included Pastor Alvarado, was a Hispanic pastor in this area. He reflects on what it's been like for him to be Hispanic evangelical leading a church that actually shared some of the concerns of white evangelicals in town about sort of government encroachment on religion and secularization and those kinds of things. Pastor Alvarado also said, I also think there's a biblical call to welcoming the foreigner. And so he doesn't say exactly who he's going to vote for in 2020, but the implication was that he had some problems with Trump, that his white colleagues and brothers and sisters, many of them did not have. I was glad that was included. I will say, Justin, as I'm reading commentary on this story, and this story was trending on Twitter. A lot of people were talking about it. A lot of people have picked out the story as an example of, look at this pastor who can't get his fellow, white pastors to care about these things. And I think that's absolutely true. I think, and we talk quite often about the narrow approach to politics that is able to avoid and ignore the concerns and interests and injustice facing so many. But I will say the flip side of this is, I didn't see a whole lot of people acknowledging Pastor Alvarado actually saying that folks had a point to be concerned about the way that Democrats were approaching religion. I didn't see a whole lot of people, like in this ironic kind of way, people were ignoring the very voice in the story that they said was most important. And that's what happens in our politics right now, too, which is whereas Pastor Alvarado's voice, not just in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party, just am so interested. This article was fascinating. Again, some of it was, it felt familiar, but because it was so, it covered so much territory, it was such a local story. So I appreciated getting to you feel like you were getting to know a certain slice of America and a certain city here. What did you think of this article?
I thought it was good. You bring up a good point. When we read articles like this, and you're seeing real people get interviewed and give their real perspectives, how do we read that article? Do we read that article trying to learn and trying to understand? Or to your point, do we read the article really just trying to find things that confirm our narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Or boost up our narrative? And I think depending on how you read this, you know, it's going to have a big deal. You know, it's going to play a big part in how and what you get from it. And so I was trying to learn from it and see, really understand the perspective of the people that were in it. And one of the main parts of this is about power. And Christians have to be very thoughtful about power, because power isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? The Bible talks about power positively in many instances. We also see power talked about when we're talking about abuses of power or sinful ways of attaining power. And so I think when we read something like this, or we just think about the politics and how power plays of politics and how power plays a part in that, Christians have to ask a couple questions. Power at what cost? And power to do what? Power to what end? Because we know that power can be used to protect us. And that's one of the points that the article hit on. That's not necessarily right. A bad thing. But should it be used by Christians mainly to protect us? Is that why? Is that the main reason we should be seeking power?
Right.
What can't we compromise even to receive this real or perceived power and protection, right? What cannot be compromised? And I think you don't see Christians always asking those questions or answering those questions properly. And that's part of the problem that I think is being addressed in this article. I think we should be suspicious of leaders who are stoking fear and are using that to their advantage, right? He's saying, I'm going to be your protector. All you need is me. And one quote, Trump says, you know, we, I guess meaning Christians, he's including himself in that, we don't exert the power that we have, right? And he basically says that if he was elected, he promised that that would change. And here's the quote. He says, Christianity will have power. Like you said, if I'm there, you're going to have plenty of power. You don't need anybody else. You're going to have somebody representing you very, very well. Remember that. And it was very effective. I mean, it was from one standpoint, kind of a brilliant way to address a group who is feeling embattled. Right.
Yeah.
And we see that, you know, it worked. 81% of white evangelicals voted for him. Right. And the question that we would ask, if we go back to those questions that I asked, power at what cost? What did they give up? Because a lot of people would say, yes, white evangelicals gained a protector, they gained power, but they lost credibility, right? And they lost that core of a faithful public witness, right? And so power can't be judged by itself. It has to be judged within the context of what's being given, what's been taken, and how you're left afterwards and what you're trying to achieve. A good quote that you see in the article says, from the start, it appeared that this was the relationship between Trump and evangelicals was an impossible contradiction, right? Evangelicals for years have defined themselves as the values voters, people who prize the Bible and sexual morality and loving your neighbor as yourself. Above all, Trump was the opposite of this. And I think it hits it on the head. That's the question that a lot of people are asking. In turn for protecting yourselves and giving you power, what did you give away? And I think what you give away is that values voters brand, if that was ever there.
Yes.
And what you pull from the Bible and how much you say you love your neighbor when you allow someone to speak in these ways to other people and don't correct it. Right.
Right.
And so, in so many ways, you know, the article just shows that Trump has turned American politics into one big contradiction, and not just on one side, on both sides. I mean, you almost forget that Trump is not Southern, nor is he a conservative, right? you'd think he was by the way that kind of coastal progressives talk about him. But the truth is that he's a progressive, you know, that the truth is that progressives basically hate one of their own, right? He came from this Northeastern liberal progressive culture. He funded their campaigns. He attended their weddings. And on the other side, the contradiction that I think the article gets right is conservatives now support and defend someone from a culture they claim to dislike and claim to be very different from, the kind of fast talking elite Northeasterner with really no blue collar bona fides, you know, and no real moral compass. So you have to ask, how did we get into this situation? And I think, as this mentioned, it was a matter of power, not principles. And for those of you who have been following the AND campaign for a long time, again, we're not going to do anything trying to lose. We strategize. We work hard to get wins for our goals, which is promoting, you know, human flourishing and defending human dignity. However, Christians have to be willing to lose if it means maintaining the witness that we should have. And so it's always the witness over the win. We've said that over and over again. But one of the things that I think you point out, and I think was good, Michael, was that we also know that white evangelicals are an easy target, right? If you want to maximize approval or likes on social media, lampooning or criticizing white evangelicals is a surefire way to go about it. We also know about the illiberalism that's going on in the Democratic Party, that's going on in academia and elsewhere. So I think when people say, why in the world do you feel under attack? I think that's a little much. Now, can it be exaggerated? Can that attack be exaggerated? Sure. Is this a bloody persecution? No. But I think there's an argument to say it's a polite persecution. And then the other thing I would say to progressives before we, you know, before folks get too self-righteous is that this happens on the left, too. I think we need to ask ourselves, why did Vice President Biden, why did Tim Kaine and many, many others change their position on abortion? Right. Was this a power transaction? I would say that I think it probably was. Why won't any other nationally known Democrat speak up and raise questions when it comes to abortion, when it comes to gender identity and those things? Is it because they're uniformly in agreement with all those things just magically over a few years? Or is it a play for power? Is it saying that I will surrender these values so that I can obtain this power that I want, this position that I want? And so it happens all the time. And this isn't to excuse white evangelicals or anything else, but I think folks on the progressive side have to ask themselves, do you have the guardrails to not go along with a progressive version of Trump, which would be very different and the issues would be different and the conversation would be different? But would you push back on that? And I thought this article brought up some of those issues very well and just gave the perspective. But I think when you trade in power for your values and for integrity, it's just not a transaction that Christians should be making. But it's not one that's only made on one side either.
That's good. That's good. We're going to take our last break. When we get back, we're going to talk about what many are saying is the looming and in some ways already here. Eviction crisis that could affect millions of our brothers and sisters. This is the Church Politics Podcast. We're back. This is the Church Politics Podcast. And Justin, you sent me this article, and there was a bit of conversation over the weekend. The U.S. Census conducted a massive survey just over the last 3 months or so, and found that an estimated 27% of adults in the U.S. missed their rent or mortgage payment for July, and over a third said during as July was coming to a close that they had listen to this, over one third, 34%, said that they had little to no confidence that they could make their August rent payment. This is most profound across the South. In Texas, this Bloomberg City Lab article with the headline one-third of American renters expected to miss their August payment by Kristen Capps, points out that in Texas, 39% of renters said they weren't certain they'd be able to pay their rent in August. In Oklahoma, that doubt is at 43%. We are looking at a potentially profound crisis. And as Benjamin Applebaum at the New York Times pointed out, it is a bit of a revisitation of 2007-2008. And Applebaum makes a passionate case that he believes it was a major mistake back then for there to be bailouts for corporations and banks, but not for homeowners. And we saw so many lose their homes and face all kinds of struggles during that crisis. And he basically says, let's not make the same mistake twice. One interesting thing he pulled out is finding the argument from Princeton sociologist Matthew Desmond, who has argued that eviction is not just a result of poverty, but a cause of poverty, and that when people lose their homes, it actually continues, exacerbates, drives a cycle of poverty that affects not just them, but obviously their kids and even the broader community. He points out that studies show they move to less expensive neighborhoods, their children end up in lower quality schools, eviction strains their ability to keep a job. If they are married, they are more likely to get divorced. And so this is a family cohesion issue. They're obviously more likely to end up homeless. This feels to me like an issue where the church is going to be required to step up in terms of caring for folks in a very direct way. And charities are going to have to step up. It also seems to me that it is potentially such a sweeping crisis, such a threat to the nation, that I agree with Applebaum that direct policy action is necessary, and not just sort of Band-Aid, but something that's going to offer real relief to people. What do you think about the fact that this tidal wave seems to be coming for so many individual people and families, one, and then the country at large? And how do we process this as Christians?
Yeah, good question. I want to be clear about one thing about this conversation about the housing crisis. And it's that we had a housing crisis before COVID hit, before the crisis. And so you better believe that this is going to be a very serious and worse crisis now that COVID has hit. And now that so many people are unemployed, we needed a paradigm shift when it came to how we think about housing in America. And now it's even more important that we focus in on this and put the partisanship aside and say, housing is a necessity. How do we make sure that we do better? Because even again, before the crisis, especially in your big urban areas, right? And especially in your big progressive cities, there was a complete failure on housing when it came to low-income people. Just a complete failure. Though that's where most of the resources are in your urban centers. That's where most people wanted to be because that's where the jobs are and so on. And a complete failure. I mean, you go to the San Franciscos, you go to the Seattles, you go to these major cities. And again, I've said this before, poor people can't even live in a lot of these places unless they're on the street. That's the way the market, the housing market has been set up in those places. And too many people who care to who say they care about the poor did nothing to prevent it, nothing to stop it. And so now is the time to really have that conversation. As you know, Michael, in Atlanta, me and some of the folks here created City Roots ATL, where we are trying to address that exact problem. And so this is, again, we bring in the conversation about the relief package. The relief package is going to be a part of it. But on a national, but really a state and local level, we're going to have to be very deliberate about how we handle this problem and making sure that we don't destabilize Americans in a number of other areas because they don't have housing. If you don't have housing, you can have other things, but everything that happens to you is going to be destabilized. You come to neighborhoods like mine and you talk to teachers. The amount of kids that are in and out of the school, don't even finish the school year, go to two or three schools a year because they don't have housing, right? So it affects education, it affects everything else. It affects what jobs that you can get. And if we're not paying attention to that, we're going to be in a very bad place. So we have to make sure that we come up with new innovative ideas and that we make this a priority when it comes to American policy. We can't just sit around and hope that people figure out where they're going to live and what they're going to do, because it throws off so many other things. And so I'm glad we're talking about this in Atlanta. We're trying to bring the church to say, this is something we care about. It doesn't matter what party you're in. We're going to deal with this crisis and we're going to find ways to be on the front lines in this conversation. You're talking about one third of Americans are not 34% are not going to be able to pay their rent in August. That should break our hearts. I don't know how many people listening to us have had unstable living conditions or not knowing where you're going to live from month to month. That is so stressful, and it impacts everything else that you think about and that you do if you don't know where you're going to be and where you're going to live. Now, the Bible speaks directly to helping people in those situations. And so Christians need to take it very seriously, because, again, this housing crisis that was here before COVID crisis hit is only going to get worse after it hits us. And I'm not going to say exactly what policy you need to push forward today. You need to be very thoughtful about how we take care of people and how we treat folks who are on the verge of being homeless.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, just as you talk and just as I think about this episode, I just feel like there's a lot to pray about. and so would urge people, I think sometimes we talk about, there are discussions about politics and we can go running everywhere else. And it's so important to hold lawmakers accountable and think about how we could be helpful in our advocacy. But whether it's struggling with COVID, whether it's worry about your neighbors being evicted, whether it's concern about how the economy is going to affect your small business that you're trying to keep afloat, these are things that we could take to the Lord and not just sort of pray and then move on as we would otherwise, but actually invite the Lord into our thinking about how to move forward, about what our perspective should be, about what our priorities should be. That's something that we try to do imperfectly here on the podcast. It's something we invite you to do as listeners. We know that these are tumultuous times, and especially we're still trying to figure out what's happening in Chicago, but there's just something happening every day, every week, it seems. Justin, I think we're nearing the end of this episode. We've covered quite a bit. You taught a constitutional law class as we talked about executive orders. We did our best to cover how Congress is tackling COVID relief and that New York Times article. Why don't you close this out?
Yeah, I just want to just reiterate to people, man, how important it is for us to try to be faithful in this moment. The world has plenty of partisans. They have plenty of people that can only think about social justice or only think about moral order, but it has too few people that can put those together. And that's really what the AND campaign is asking people to do. Seek to be faithful and have the faith to know that it works out from there. We're not just about power, but when we have power, we want to use it not just for ourselves, but for others. And so I'll just hit y'all with the outro. Listen, Ann Camp, there is a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. We'll holler at you.
Have a blessed week. Thanks, y'all. Came out of Nazareth. This is the groove. Tell me, can you handle it? I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave. I'm unchained. I'm Frederick Douglass with a fame.